Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Ashley Thompson, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Brian Lynn.
Researchers say they have discovered new details about the day an asteroid hit Earth and killed off the dinosaurs. Scientists believe the asteroid struck the Earth about 65 million years ago near what is today Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The force of the massive asteroid crash is estimated to have been equal to the strength of about 10 billion nuclear bombs. The U.S. space agency NASA has estimated the strike created a huge crater about 180 kilometers wide and 900 meters deep. The event is believed to have caused widespread wildfires, earthquakes, and ocean waves, or tsunamis. It also released chemicals into the atmosphere, leading to severe cooling that harmed many living things. Scientists blame this climate-changing event for causing the extinction of more than 70% of plant and animal life. In addition, all dinosaurs that were not bird-like died out. The crater remained hidden until the late 1970s, when it was first discovered beneath the ocean by a team searching for petroleum. The theory about an asteroid causing the extinction of the dinosaurs was first presented by two American scientists in 1980. Studies based on materials collected over the years from off the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula led most scientists to agree that an asteroid struck in that place. In 2016, a team went to the area to drill down into the ground beneath the crater to bring up rock samples. One of the leaders of that team was Sean Gulick, a research professor at the University of Texas Institute for Geophysics. He also led a new study that researchers say provides more evidence and details about the destruction caused by the asteroid. The study involved the examination of more than 130 meters of rock believed to have built up in the seconds and hours after the asteroid strike. The findings were recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's an expanded record of events that we were able to recover from within Ground Zero, Gulick said in a statement. It tells us about impact processes from an eyewitness location. He added that the rock record offers the most detailed look yet into the period immediately after the asteroid impact. The researchers noted that the buildup of material was one of the largest in Earth's history. The materials and formations in the rocks provide evidence of what was happening in the environment right after the event. By examining the rocks, the team found evidence that most of the material that filled the crater after the strike was produced where the impact happened. This included materials that were vaporized from the blast. Some of the material was carried in by seawater pouring back into the crater from the surrounding Gulf of Mexico. The researchers also found evidence of burned material, sulfur, and dust. They believe these substances were vaporized and entered into the atmosphere. They said that these substances blocked the sun's heat and caused the Earth to cool. The team also found material they believe came from the fungal breakdown of wood within or just above layers of sand. This also showed signs of trees and plant life being drawn into the crater by resurging waters, likely caused by a huge wave or tsunami. Sean Gulick said the evidence suggests that a large heat blast, followed by a period of intense cooling, killed off the dinosaurs. "We fried them and then we froze them," he said. Gulick noted that the study provides clear evidence that the dinosaurs did not die from the asteroid impact. Instead, the research suggests they did not survive the resulting climate conditions. "The real killer has got to be atmospheric," Gulick said. "The only way you get a global mass extinction like this is an atmospheric effect." I'm Brian Lynn.
Argentina is one of the world's leaders in beef consumption. Many people there love to eat meat. But the country's meat-eating tradition is being threatened by a growing number of vegetarians and vegans, especially among young people. A recent online questionnaire found that 6 out of every 10 Argentines are willing to stop eating beef. Adrian Bifferetti is head of marketing at the Institute for the Promotion of Beef. He wrote a report about the online survey. Bifferetti noted that the findings show a growing cultural divide. The younger generations have grown up amid the debate over abortion in Congress, inclusion, gender equality. These collective questions have started to gain weight in decisions about the purchase of foods, he said. The Chamber of Commerce for Beef and its Derivatives reported in July that Argentines are consuming on average 50 kilograms of beef a year. That number represents what it calls the lowest level of meat consumed in the country's history. "This concern about cruelty and slaughter is here and is going to be felt," Bifferetti said. He added that movements from other parts of the world are arriving in Argentina. "It is starting to be a challenge," he said. The cultural divide was clear several weeks ago when animal activists gathered near an event at the Buenos Aires Rural Society. They were met by cattle ranchers who charged at them on horses. Much of the anti-beef activism comes from vegans. Veganism developed as a movement in London during World War II. It is based on a diet free of animal products. Vegans also reject animal labor or use of animals in scientific experiments. There are no official numbers in Argentina, but Adrian Bifferetti's group estimates vegans and vegetarians represent 7% to 8% of the population. "I don't love eating animals," said Melissa Arouge, a 25-year-old. "Without a doubt, I estimate that in 10 to 15 years, a large part of the population will be vegetarian. I don't know if they will be vegan," she added. "The change will be little by little." A group of young people from the animal liberation group Boycott held a protest on a recent Saturday. They gathered at the entrance to a meat processing center in Buenos Aires. "It makes me very sad. Words are not enough for me to apologize to the animals because they have miserable lives. They are born with a date to die," said one protester, Jasmine Romero. She wore clothing with the words, "We are the species threatening to destroy everything." On the other side of the divide, many Argentines see eating beef as part of their history and culture. "We aren't talking about killing the animal for sport. The animal is being transformed into food," said Bevoretti. "It has been like this throughout the history of humanity." I'm John Russell.
The government in Ghana has announced plans to increase the incomes of cocoa farmers. But cocoa farms are being destroyed with or without the permission of farmers. Many cocoa farmers cannot do anything about the situation because they rent the land. The landowners are ending their leases early to develop other crops. This month, a bulldozer cleared the land Ama Serwa rented in Asikesu for growing cocoa and other crops. Serwa is the breadwinner of her family. Now she is trying to think of how to support her children and grandchildren. Asikesu is an area in Ghana famous for growing cocoa. The country supplies about 20% of the world's total cocoa crop. Many hectares of cocoa trees, like Serwa's, have been destroyed in Asikesu. Farmers like Serwa have toiled for years growing their crops on land they do not own or have control over. They believe the land was cleared to raise cattle. Serwa said the money she received for the loss of her crops was not enough, and with the land and her crops gone, she said she does not know how she can feed her family. David Server is another former cocoa farmer. He returned to look at the recently destroyed land on which he once farmed. Server used the profits from his cocoa farming to help pay for his children's school fees. Now, with no land to farm cocoa, Server cannot pay his rent. He has been told to leave his home. "About 2 weeks now, I have not had sleep," he said. Thinking, because all what I have done in my lifetime has gone forever. And it's like I'm alive, but I'm dead." In Ghana, a government body makes rules for the cocoa industry. This government body sets the price that growers earn from their beans. Earlier this year, Ghana added a living income differential fee of $400 on every ton of cocoa beans sold on the market. The country did this with the aim of improving the livelihoods of farmers. The Concerned Farmers Association does not believe the move will help. The president of the association is Nana Obawadia Opambor Boateng Bonsu. He said Ghana's cocoa farmers need to protect the crop on which they depend. Bonsu said This is a serious challenge, and it's something that we have been fighting for so long. But it seems the government has put wax in its ears, because government is not all that serious about this cocoa issue. The Ghana Cocoa Board sets rules for the cocoa industry in the country. It says the major issue is farmers losing their land. The agency said farmers rent land from chiefs, who later take it back when they see other opportunities. While the cocoa agency works with chiefs to fight against the practice, it does not have the right to tell landowners what to do with their property. However, officials say the group offers legal representation to farmers to deal with payment for lost property. I'm Ashley Thompson.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. That Constitution, with other amendments added over the years, is still the law of the land. The delegates agreed to start the convention as soon as 7 states were represented. On May 25th, they finally began. They gathered in the same room where America's Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The first important decision was choosing a president for the convention. Several of the delegates urged the others to choose George Washington. Washington was the most famous man in America. He had led the forces that won the war for independence from Britain. The delegates agreed. Washington was their choice. George Washington officially opened the convention with a short speech. He thanked the delegates for naming him president of the convention. But, he said, the honor was too great. He asked the delegates to forgive him if he made mistakes. After all, he said, he had never been chairman of a meeting before. With those words, George Washington sat down. Here are 2 actors playing George Washington and James Madison. They discuss Washington's role in writing the Constitution.
As for that document, I merely stood back and let the learned gentlemen do their work. I believe I spoke only once in convention, and that to a minor point.
Well, I believe you do yourself an injustice, sir. As president of the convention, you led the way.
Washington did lead the way, but it was not a straight path. From the beginning, the delegates agreed that they had the right to change their decisions. This was the rule. The convention did not just discuss a proposal, vote on it, and move on to other issues. Any delegate could ask to again discuss any proposal or any decision, and they often did. The same speeches that were made the first time
were made again. So days, even weeks, passed between discussions of the same proposal. The delegates also agreed on a rule of secrecy. Guards were placed at the doors of the State House. Newspaper reporters were not allowed inside, and the delegates were not allowed to discuss convention business in public. The secrecy rule led people to think all kinds of things about the convention. This was true especially in Europe. There, most people believed the convention was discussing how America could be ruled by a king. Europeans said a republican government worked in a small country, such as Switzerland, but it would not work, they said, in a land as large as America. At the time of the convention, Thomas Jefferson was serving as America's representative to France. When he learned of the secrecy rule, he was angry. He believed strongly in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. More than 40 years later, James Madison explained the decision behind the secrecy rule. Madison said that if the convention had been open to the public, no delegate would ever have changed his mind after speaking on an issue. To do so would mean he was wrong the first time he spoke, and no delegate would be willing to admit to the public that he had made a mistake. This was Madison's reasoning. If the meetings had been open, he said, the convention would have failed. Another rule helped the delegates speak freely. They used a method of debate known as the Committee of the Whole. It was useful then, and it is still used today in legislatures. Votes taken in the committee are not recorded as final votes. The Committee of the Whole provides a way for people to discuss ideas and vote, but also to change their minds. To have the Philadelphia Convention become a committee of the whole, the delegates needed to elect a chairman of the committee. They chose Nathaniel Gorham, a judge from Massachusetts. Each morning at 10 o'clock, the convention met and declared that it was sitting as a committee of the whole. George Washington then left the president's chair. Nathaniel Gorham took his place. Just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Committee of the Whole declared it was sitting again as a convention. Gorham would step down, Washington would take the chair, and declare that the convention would meet again the next morning. This process was repeated each day. Because of these rules, the story of the Philadelphia Convention would be difficult to understand if we told about events day by day. So we will put the calendar and the clock away and tell how each major issue was debated and settled. On May 29th, the delegates heard what was called the Virginia Plan. This was the plan of government prepared by James Madison and other delegates from Virginia. The Virginia Plan did more than suggest changes to the Articles of Confederation. It was, in fact, a plan for a completely new central government. Immediately, the 33-year-old governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, proposed an amendment. The Virginia Plan, he noted, spoke of a federal union of states. But such a federation would not work, he said. Instead, Randolph suggested that the central government should be a national government. It should contain a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. For a few moments, there was complete silence. Many of the delegates seemed frozen in their chairs. Did they hear correctly? Most of them did not question the idea of a government with three separate branches. Several states already had such a system. But to create a central government that was national and supreme, what did these words mean exactly? What was the difference? The delegates debated the meaning of the words federal, national, and supreme for many days. Both James Madison and a Pennsylvania delegate, Governor Morris, tried to explain. Madison said a federal government acts on states. A national government acts directly on the people. Morris gave this explanation. A federal government is simply an agreement based on the good faith of those involved. A national government has a complete system of operation and its own powers. Governor Morris pointed out that one day the delegates meeting in Philadelphia would be dead. Their children and grandchildren, he said, would stop thinking of themselves as citizens of Pennsylvania or New York or North Carolina. Instead, they would think of themselves as citizens of the United States. Morris said the states had to take second place to a national government with supreme power. Other delegates presented their own plans for discussion. Alexander Hamilton of New York suggested giving the national government almost unlimited powers. Hamilton's ideas were not popular. After Hamilton's five-hour speech, one delegate said, "Hamilton is praised by everybody. He is supported by no one." New Jersey also offered a plan. An actor playing James Madison at a museum in Washington, D.C. says that plan was not popular either.
And William Paterson unveiled the New Jersey plan, calling for one house of equal representation. I knew that Delaware, Rhode Island, and the other small states would never go along with that.
Delegates voted to reject the New Jersey plan. They did not even vote on Hamilton's plan. From that time, all their discussions were about the plan presented by Virginia. For more than 3 months, delegates would debate each part, vote on it, then debate it again. The Virginia Plan formed the basis of discussion at the convention in Philadelphia. In the end, it formed the basis of the United States Constitution.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.